Welcome, this is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's currently the 21st of June, 2012, and today we're talking once again to Jo Nova of joannenova.com.au. She's a libertarian and a blogger, and her website is about science, carbon, climate, and tax, and tackling tribal groupthink. Of course, she's a children's TV series presenter on Channel 9, who has done over 200 radio interviews, mainly on the Australian ABC. She's been oft-cited by numerous publications talking about climate science and climate change, and she's also the author of The Skeptic's Handbook and a previous guest on this program as well. So, Jo Nova, it's great to have you back on the program. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, James.
Well, as people out there may or may not know, we are currently undergoing Rio Plus 20, a United Nations conference on environment and development, which is the 20th anniversary of the Earth Summit that took place in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, 20 years ago in 1992. And that was the catalyst behind the Climate Change Convention and the Kyoto Protocol. So now we are here 20 years later, kind of in the wake of the destruction of the Kyoto Protocol and the admitted failure of that. And this conference has some pretty lofty aims, including promoting economic growth and overcoming poverty, increasing social justice and reducing inequality, and protecting and nurturing the environment and the global commons, which is a mouthful and a half, and so a lot of lofty rhetoric that I think few people would disagree with in the general. But of course, we're talking once again about how best to reduce carbon through international treaties, etc. So, Jo Nova, I wanted to have you on the program today to talk about this international process, something akin to the UNFCCC that we see coming about every year and those types of deliberations about what can be done, hand-wringing about the carbon that's going into the atmosphere. Perhaps we can put some perspective on this. What do you think is the significance of this summit, and where is the international community heading on these types of issues?
We're at a transition point. The global warming scare is obviously dying, and people are admitting it on both sides of the fence, and they're saying so apparently openly at the Rio conference, at least openly to other people who are delegates there, which is tricky. Of course, they're surrounded by other people of a similar nature and similar ilk, and they're often very candid about what they say. And CFACT is a group that deserves a lot of attention for having taken the effort to go to Rio. They've got reporters on the ground, and they have caught people saying things to them, essentially saying that, and here, I'll just read one from Huxley Lawler. He's the executive coordinator of the environment and climate change of the Gold Coast City Council in Australia. Now, in Australia, city councils are pretty important in this because they, many of them are going to be paying big carbon tax sums, and also many of them have taken up the ICLEI, which stands for the International Council of Local Environmental Initiatives, which is an Agenda 21 kind of operation running through local councils. And it all sounds so harmless running through local councils, but this is a vast international collective, I guess, of local councils putting together aims that some would describe as very socialist, almost communist in some ways. And so here's this executive coordinator admitting to the CFACT executive director, Craig Rucker, that bluntly he said, we don't use the term climate change anymore. It's sustainable development now. So another CFACT staffer confirmed the conversation with other people. Paul Chambers is a sustainability manager for the Auckland Council in New Zealand. And Chambers said it was important to use inexact environmental protection terminology when dealing with conservative governments. So there you go. They're quite happy to admit. And remember, all the time they believe they're doing the right thing by the environment and they're helping the planet and helping the people. But we have to be so wary of these good intentions because, after all, those who are con artists come at us with good intentions too. A con artist never comes to you saying, I'm here to take your money. So to me, this is just a giant big government gab fest, and when we say giant, the number of attendees, I've heard 45,000 people are going or are at Rio, and you think about the size of that. I mean, that must compare to something like the Olympics, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it truly seems enormous, the number of people, the cost, the flights, the accommodation, the expenses, the petrol, the carbon emissions. So it is a major thing, and some of the most scary aspects of this is, I was just reading last night, Christopher Monckton was saying that the non-government delegates, which means him and anyone who's not an official representative of a government, have been locked out of the drafts and they cannot read any of the advanced copies on paper beforehand. They've been locked out of the room.
Perhaps learning some of the lessons from Copenhagen and some of the past failed UNFCCC conferences.
Well, yes. I mean, Monckton was so successful at Durban when he released some of their extraordinary, it seemed quite clumsy, claims that they were putting through in Durban, and foiled that entirely by, well, embarrassing them all over the web with links to their draft copy. I think what's up with that? It's hosted the Durban copy of the draft treaty, and it was the most popular blog on WordPress that day, which is enormous. You know, WordPress has got 500,000 blogs, so it attracted a lot of attention. And that, I think, is how we do this. We need to expose what they're up to and what their aims are and these so-called treaties. I find it quite disturbing what's going on behind the scenes. Just the sheer numbers in this is quite large. Apparently they're asking for things, taxation on international transactions. I mean, there's an enormous money-making scheme, and we're very distant from that money. The money we pay to our federal governments is, or our local councils, at least we have some voting control over how they spend and misspend it. It's limited, but there's some control. But when it comes to the UN, we virtually have nothing at all. We just have to lobby our representatives in our governments, I guess. And to me, this is a very distant thread from democracy. And that is why I think personally we should be defunding and reducing our funding for most of the UN arms, knocking it back to just the ones which are really, truly the most important.
Well, as you point out, this is part of an international agenda, and in fact, Agenda 21 is something that we've oft heard about, but tend to know very little about. Let's talk a little bit about what this is and where it came from and how it's being pushed at this conference.
Look, I think James Dellingpole's description of Agenda 21 was just the best, and he wrote in his book, Watermelons, he said, look, you know, like most people, he thought it didn't amount to much, and I agree with him, I didn't either. He said it sort of sounded like Agenda 21 sounds like what, Area 51, you know, the Roswell side where the aliens land and whatnot. It sounds like nutbag kind of stuff and the kind of thing that you don't really need to worry about. And the fact that it was done in Rio 20 years ago, I mean, really, seriously, as James points out, if it was important, surely we would have heard by now. And it also was non-binding, voluntary commitments and whatnot. But as James points out, those non-binding voluntary commitments are easy for governments to sign because they can sign anything that's non-binding. But what happens after that is that the UN has this enormous machinery and thousands of volunteer helpers and non-volunteers, the people who are paid by World Wildlife Fund and Greenpeace and whatnot, who are hundreds of billions of dollars in those corporations. There's a whole army of people there to try and force governments to stick to their voluntary commitments. So in a sense, it's a voluntary commitment and it's easy for them to sign. But in the real world, they often end up trying to meet these agreements that they signed off so quickly to and that voters had no say in at the time.
So in one sense, these types of conferences can lead to these lofty statements that we all hear about and, you know, everyone gets applauded at the end of the conference, but then they go home and reality sets in. But there's the other side of that, as you say, as people struggle to at least maintain the face of these types of agreements. And it did take the better part of 20 years for Kyoto to openly fall apart, although no one's really been going along with it for that long. So do you think, I mean, is this something that we need to be generally paying attention to? Do we have to be concerned with what our so-called leaders are signing us onto at conferences like these, or can we safely afford to ignore this?
Well, you know, in this day and age of austerity, I think we should not only be focused on what they're aiming to do, but just what they're doing currently. And if we think of the cost of sending 45,000 people on a long holiday to Rio, then surely voters and journalists need to start paying attention to just whether we can afford these kind of large functions, which, when we look at the science behind them, is so paper thin. I mean, these claims by James Hansen that we will lose half of all species by 2100. That's just extraordinary. Now, James Hansen is an astronomer. If a physicist speaks out on climate change, people howl him down and say, you know, it's not his turf, he's speaking outside his specialty. But here's James Hansen, an astronomer, saying half of all species will be extinct by 2100. It's so incredible. It's ridiculous. We look at the facts, and thanks to Matt Ridley, I've got some data sitting in front of me, pointing out that in the last 400 years, about 1.3% of mammals and 1.4% of birds have become extinct. Now, every extinction is a tragedy, so we shouldn't be proud of those figures, But this is nothing like the 50% that James Hansen is saying will theoretically happen by 2100. And extinctions, by the way, apparently peaked in 1900 at about 1.6 per annum and have fallen since then to about 0.2 per annum. So we appear to be doing a lot better now than 100 years ago. And I think a lot of that is due to economic wealth, because countries with wealth, of course, have the money to be able to look after their forests and trees. That's where the best national parks in the world are, of course, in these dastardly, evil, wealthy countries who can afford to set aside lands and areas and to look after them and set quotas. And the biggest environmental damage is going on in the poor countries, where the best thing we can do for them, I think, is take away these giant bureaucratic money-feeding machines that really funnel money through the UN and other groups to corrupt leaders in those countries, and help those countries get on their feet with real free market, a true free market and world trade that is, I guess, you know, the products that they can make, agricultural products. So it's the libertarian in me speaking again.
Well, you'll find a ready audience for that, I think, on the Corbett Report. But certainly, it boggles my mind that people like James Hansen would be listening to his pronouncements, given that it was his pronouncements on the likely outcome of climate change back in the 1980s that started a lot of the hype around this. And yet they've all proven disastrously.
Exactly. Not even below his lowest kind of estimates of things. Now, apparently, and again, going back to something Matt Ridley sent me, the estimate of 40,000 species going extinct every year came originally from a conservationist called Norman Myers in 1979. So these numbers have been knocking around for ages. And he wasn't the only one. E.O. Wilson, the Harvard biologist, apparently also spoke of about 27,000 species going extinct each year, was his forecast. So there have been plenty of others who put forward these dire predictions. Hansen's just the latest in a long line of them. But again, and those numbers I quoted before, about 1.6 extinctions per annum in 1900, came from the American Museum of Natural History. So looking at the credible data, we should be concerned about species extinction, but we shouldn't be trumpeting these ridiculous proposals that we're going to lose so many of them by 2100. And yes, we do need to be aware that they are simply changing the goalposts. And the real aim of these things, the Rio 20 and whatnot, is the aim is to get more power to the UN, more money to the bureaucrats and the people who work in that system, which is not open to competition. In the sense that those of us who work in a free market have to compete with ideas, with money, and placing money on the table that belongs to people who are very interested in getting it back and making sure it works. The UN is funded through this distant mechanism of money from governments where voters have very little say in where the money goes. And they essentially operate in a competitive free environment. I mean, we've been calling them the regulating class, because to me they operate through regulation rather than through competition. And they get a monopoly, as the UN has, and become almost unstoppable. And in a sense, they're a huge threat to the people of the planet. I mean, we look at biofuels and this concern about the CO2 levels caused possibly, as estimated by Indira Gulkarni and published in the Journal of American Physicians and Surgeons, the biofuels mortality has increased about 200,000 deaths in 2010 alone. So that's in a single year. But because they used corn to feed cars instead of corn to feed starving children in Haiti and whatnot. So when you look at it like that, these kind of things are not just a waste of money, but they're absolutely deadly. And we need to turn the torch onto this and start getting governments to do the right thing by, I think we should bring them back to national level projects rather than foreign aid that's given to international global corporate and bodies and whatnot. Does that make sense?
It certainly does, and I think you're right to identify the regulating class as being this sort of superstructure that's being built up through these international conferences that presume to have the right to make these kinds of decisions. And of course, the regulating class has to rely on certain myths and assumptions and overarching narratives that they can use to convince the people why they should even exist at all. And I think you're right to also highlight that this is a transitional period where they're transitioning off of the climate change myth that has been promoted so strongly, strenuously for the last few decades because it is falling apart. And I think that in itself is a hopeful sign and perhaps a sign that once these narratives are deconstructed, it's much more difficult for this regulating class to function. So I actually would like to turn people's attention to an excellent post that you have up right at the top of joannenova.com.au right now, Nature and that problem of defining Homo sapiens denier. Is it English or newspeak? And this relates to something that was published in Nature by Dr. Paul Bryan and a few others. And you had an excellent letter, I think, to Dr. Bryan. Perhaps you can tell people a little bit about this post.
Well, there was a new paper, as you said, put out in Nature Climate Change called Promoting Pro-Environmental Action in Climate Change Deniers. And it discusses climate change deniers almost like they're a guaranteed subspecies of the human race, who are obviously wrong. That's just an assumption built into this paper. And the word denier is used over and over again. And denier is one of my pet hates. It's one of those words which is ultimately incredibly insulting, especially to people. And we have Nobel Prize-winning physicists who have come down on the side of skepticism about the claims of global warming. So some of these people are our most esteemed, most awarded scientists in the last 50 years, and they've come down on the side of the skeptics. So to call them deniers, which suggests a brain that's not capable of reason, a brain which is beyond logic and is into that emotional state, is incredibly insulting. And there's the link also to the Holocaust denial movement, which of course is just ugly in every sense of the word, though they should be allowed to speak, says the libertarian. So when I saw this, of course it makes your blood boil to read these kind of things with the word denier all through it, but we calmed down and realised that the lead researchers in this probably just have never really come across the subjects that they're claiming to study. And they've picked up in the order around about, I think, $300,000 from the Australian government to do these studies over 3 years. And they've gone and investigated this class of deniers but never tested their base assumption, which is what are the deniers really on about? And to do that, they would go to the leaders of the movement, wouldn't they? I mean, that's the obvious place to look if you want to understand a movement, is to talk to the leaders. But they never do. They always interview people off the street. And, of course, the science and the topics that they get out of that kind of level of conversation is never going to be the sort which is what the issue is really about. If there was a real concern over carbon dioxide warming the planet, I think there's a layer of people out there who are the really sharp tools in the shed who would look at things and who'd come down on the side that the UN and the others are on if there was evidence for it. And they'd say, well, yeah, look, we really should be doing something. We can argue about what we should do, but not argue about whether we need to do something. But it isn't like that at all. These influential people, who are often not in the media but quiet, they're the ones who are, you know, good friends of prime ministers because prime ministers knew them at university or whatnot. And it's informal. It's not published, so we don't see it in the mainstream media. But this level of thinkers, I guess, they're operating through the highest bands of connections of companies and corporates. They're advising people to pull their money out of green markets. They can see the writing on the wall with this. They're saying, you know, wind and solar are totally reliant on these government subsidies. So pull your investments out of that area because it can only go down from here. Without government propping, you stand to lose everything. Those businesses go bust, as in Solyandra in the US. Whereas, you know, companies like Exxon and whatnot, even if CO2 was a problem and we act against it, those companies don't have it's not an all or nothing thing for them. They will still make profits where people will still need oil 10 or 20 years from now. So for them, it's a very different ballgame. And people don't seem to realise often the enormous stakes on the cards for things like the renewable energy industry. And in the EU, it's just collapsing as we speak, and people are pulling out. I think Germany just shut down one of its carbon trading markets because they simply just didn't have the volume, which is extraordinary for something which was so big only 4 years ago.
Exactly right. And yet still we have, for example, the Christian Science Monitor coming out today about Rio Plus 20. The Earth Summit should look to reduce black carbon through carbon trading. So the same ideas keep getting dredged up at these types of conferences over and over, even though they've demonstrably failed in the past.
Well, again, I think we need to consider each of the trading ideas on their own benefits and costs and whatnot. And for me, the big thing that fails with CO2, the reason why a free market solution is not a solution for CO2, when I am a free market girl most of the time, is that CO2 is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. You know, mice breathe CO2 out, and so do the yeast, the algae. They're all working with CO2 and the plants and whatnot. Even the rocks, damn it, the rocks have got a role in CO2. So when you're looking at something that is ubiquitous, we automatically have to create people who are included and who are excluded, rocks. Who's going to pay the rock share or take the reward for what the rocks do in terms of binding CO2 and making it limestone? So automatically it doesn't work with a free market, because so many of the players in there can't possibly pay or get paid for their role in the entire cycle. And the accounting for it all, the auditing of the accounting, just astronomical. So it was never a market that was going to work. It was hard to audit, difficult to monitor, expensive to track down who was emitting it. Because it's a gas that spreads so far and wide so quickly, it's not easy to track levels close to a factory and see that it tallies and whatnot. In the end, that was never going to be a solution. Black carbon, maybe. I'm open to suggestion on whether a free market might be useful for black carbon. It definitely does seem to be a pollutant. It's possibly the reason why the Arctic sea ice is declining. It has had some summer declines. When you drop all that black dust all over the white ice, it changes the albedo, the way the light reflects off the ice. So in that case, it could well be that there is a human influence on the Arctic sea ice, and it could be that it's the shipping tracks, because there's so much shipping traffic going across close by, leaving that black dust from their diesel exhaust. And diesel particulates too, some of them most nasty carcinogens known to man. So there are definitely real pollutants out there. Whether we need a free market on black carbon, I'm not sure. I would be sceptical of initial claims. I'd like to see it backed up.
Well, then, coming to the fundamental theme of this conversation, am I overly optimistic to think that perhaps there is something positive from the fact that people are stepping away from climate change and trying to focus on other issues? Or is this just an endlessly repeating cycle that no matter how many myths we knock down, that they'll just have a new one up their sleeve to continue the agenda?
That's it. I think we have to actually knock on the head the idea that we need a government, an intra-governmental body to do this. The world is not ready for that yet. We can't possibly vote on a giant intergovernmental body. It's not possible on a worldwide scale. I think we should be highly suspect of anything coming out of the UN. I would like to see, there are real environmental problems which are international ones, but for those, I think we can rely on national governments of Western countries at least doing the right thing. If only we could highlight those problems and put them forward and just rely on the old human thing of shame, that reputation thing, the idea that you should do the right thing because you should do the right thing, not because there's a market involved. I really don't think our worldwide democratic systems are even remotely close to coping with a worldwide government, and I just see tyranny and corruption coming out of these large international deals. I mean, they're trying to do everything with the UN. It's extraordinary. They've packed just about every kind of claim in there, from how many children people should be allowed to have to everything about how we use our water resources, our ground, our mining, the air, the way we travel to and from work, in whether we ride or choose a bike, although everything. So there's almost every aspect of our life that people are trying to regulate here. And my real concern is we're getting far too far away from any control by the people.
I think you're exactly right on that point. Well, certainly, I hope that people are checking joannenova.com.au for more on these types of issues and all of the great work you're doing there. But on Rio Plus 20 specifically, is there anyone that you would recommend, or any websites that you'd like to direct people to keep an eye on what's happening there?
Look, I really think Climate Depot, Mark Morano, and CFACT are on the money with this. They've got the people down there on the site and are reporting back daily on it. And coming from CFACT, here's just a little paragraph saying today over 1.5 billion people still don't have electricity, or they have it only a few hours each day or a week. Almost 2.5 billion people live on less than $2 a day. Millions are dying every year from diseases that could be largely eradicated by access to reliable, affordable electricity for cooking and refrigeration, for hospitals, for clean water, for sanitation. these are the kind of issues that we need to focus on, and all credit to CFAC for sending people down there. And we should be very, very concerned. Mark Morano, who has been to nearly all of these giant gabfests who were hosted by the UN, said this Rio one today is the first time, it's unprecedented, that they have ever locked out all of the NGOs and other people who are approved delegates and are supposed to be allowed to be at this conference, but they've locked all of the government reps in one room and said, well, you're not allowed to tell anyone, you're not allowed to leak a document out. It's just totally it's totally non-transparent. And he said that's unprecedented. So we're seeing them stoop to newer, lower levels now in desperation, I guess, hoping to pull these scams off, which in the end will just mean more money for the UN, more jobs for the boys. And remember, when we worry about what they're coming up with at Rio, they have already got Rio. They have already got these international gabfests where 40,000 people travel around the world for a holiday in a tropical place. Yeah, that's a pretty big win on its own. And not to mention the billions of dollars of funding that governments promised after even things that are called failures like Copenhagen. So we need to be very vigilant and wary. And even though we do seem to be winning the climate change debate, we have to keep the pressure up. Absolutely.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there for now. But again, I hope people are following you at joannenova.com.au. So, Joannenova, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, James.